Today, on Shipment from Shiloh, I sit down with former Android Netrunner lead designer Damon Stone to learn about the development of the revised core set. Then, we analyze the biggest changes for each faction. Finally, Damon gives his thoughts on the future of Netrunner. All this and more on Shipment from Shiloh. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Shipment from Shiloh, a Netrunner community podcast. I'm your host, Graham, and today I have a very special guest. It's my pleasure to bring to you the man, the myth, the Mason Bellamy himself, Mr. Damon Stone. Damon, how are you today, man?
I'm doing well, Graham. How about yourself?
I'm having a great day. Someone posted on my local Netrunner Facebook group, "What a time to be alive," right? FFG really rocked the Netrunner world this week with what I'm going to call the biggest announcement in Android Netrunner history. Not to overhype it.
No, I'm sure it'll totally live up to that.
But it is a big deal. So now, you don't work for FFG anymore, but it's my understanding that you played an instrumental role in the development of the revised core when you were the lead designer of Netrunner. Would you say that's right?
Yeah. So when Lucas was lead designer and I was a designer on the game with him, we had been talking for a while about, you know, what we would do if we could just do it all again. You know, knowing what we know now, what people gravitate towards, and, you know, the proper kind of scaling to get the kind of pace that we want in a game. And the core set has cards that turned out to be too weak and cards that turned out to be too powerful. And we would love to be able to just redo them. That was never really an option. Like, I won't go heavily into the logistics. I've talked about it in a couple places and at least one other podcast. But the logistics for that sort of thing is crazy, crazy town. It's super involved. Yeah. And not to mention the fact that because of all of that, there was just no way that the executives at FFG or Asmodee North America were ever going to buy into the, "Let's just replace the whole thing."
Right. I mean, that's a big hit to your consumer base, right? Drawing the comparison to something like a Game of Thrones where you do a whole game reboot, like, you're kind of starting from scratch in a way. You already have people who are interested in the old game, but having a total new reboot it's a totally new game at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if we had thought about going the AGOT route, that would absolutely be true. We were thinking of, but knowing that that was just not possible with Netrunner, we were thinking more along the lines of just rotating the core set and adding a completely new core set. So the fundamentals of the game stay the same. It's just that, you know, sort of the base product changes. But even that, it was problematic. And, you know, we were essentially told it's not going to happen. Like, there's that is too involved. It requires too much work. And there is not nearly enough of a guarantee that it will be successful by pretty much any measurement. Sure. So not just money. And I know people like to go, like, Fantasy Flight Games is a company and all they care about is making money. And
it's kind of a central purpose to having a business, though, right?
You need to be able to stay in business to have a business. But that said, it's, you know, like, and I'm sure most people aren't going to believe me, it's really not about the money for a lot of the things that we do. The designers, and even like Christian, who was at the time that we were, you know, plotting, was the chief executive officer, are fans of the games first. And so we really try to look at everything that we can from the perspective of, you know, what is going to provide the best play experience, and then how can we make money off of that?
Sure.
So, you know, it was like replacing this whole thing, making everybody buy a new core, it was going to cause a fair amount of problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that neither of those two things we had talked about were things that, you know, Lucas and I had seriously like pitched to the executives, but we did do some definite sounding out, like, we recognize some problems, you know, here are some things that are going on in the community, here's some of the things that our testing is showing, and, you know, finding a way to solve it that was different than just another expansion, and hoping that problem cards and, you know, things that expose problems in the core set or cause the core set cards to become problematic, you know, to rotate out was not an ideal fashion.
Right.
You know, that wasn't going to make enough people happy, and it was not going to create the world that Lucas and I wanted. So he and I, you know, bent our heads together, and I believe that he is the one that came up with the original concept of replacing the trouble cards with cards from the first two cycles that would be rotating. And so we sort of talked about what that would mean and laid out some specific cards that we knew were definitely at the top of our, you know, individual lists, saw where there was crossover. And then he wrote up a pitch and presented it to the executives and then said, okay, you guys seem to have a pretty good handle on this. You know, let me see what a proposed core set would look like. And at this point, Lucas was, had already left as, or was on his way out. I can't remember exactly which it was. Sure. For lead designer. So I took his list, I took my list, and then I started pulling players, both playtesters and not playtesters, you know, in as subtle a way as possible, what their favorite cards were, you know, what cards they hated, and just sort of took note of all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what gave me my first rough draft of cards to consider. And then it was a case of taking a look at what cards people said that they really liked from the first two cycles and seeing where I could match one for one or make some small adjustments in one direction and refocus, you know, a faction into a slightly different area to give them some new stuff that is important, but take away some stuff that had some problems.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, sorry, long story short, yes, the actual product that you hold was mostly the product of my work, with Lucas having pitched and sold the executives on it. And then, of course, Michael Boggs having done the final product development and production work for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk a little bit about that, the classic core set one, if you want. Now, did you play a role in the development of that originally?
I would have to say no. The closest that I could lay claim to that is I did a lot of the play testing from the very, very, very beginning.
Sure.
But that core set is really the labor of love of Lucas Litzinger. I mean, yeah. It was... Yeah, that was his baby, and he did an amazing job of it.
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring it up because, you know, any time that we discuss Netrunner in the early days, particularly with just that core set, I really feel like we got to sing our praises out for Lucas, because none of us would be here if the game wasn't good enough from the very beginning. If that first core set was not good enough, it was just okay, if it was boring or whatever, we wouldn't care. And then we wouldn't have all these wonderful, you know, podcasts and Facebook groups and meetups and everything else. So
yeah, no, Lucas deserves all of the praise for that. The first core set was just really well executed. Yeah. I know a lot. It's easy to look back after multiple years of, you know, playing and testing and designing and development and see where, you know, things didn't quite clicked the way that we wanted to, but he was going in, you know, essentially blind. Like, this is the game that I want to make. And
yeah.
he did an amazing job. You're absolutely right. None of this would exist if he hadn't had, you know, such a strong design vision.
Yeah. So let's talk about designing a core set for a game. So I have not made a game myself, but I would imagine that for a card game like this, particularly with an LCG model where you're releasing a core set that's meant to be kind of standalone, trying to find that sweet spot for the power level of cards has to be difficult, right? Because if you don't make enough powerful cards in the core set, then your game isn't really exciting at all, right? But if you make too powerful of cards, then sometimes games can become less skill rewarding because it depends on when you draw these really strong cards or whatever.
No, absolutely. You pretty much nailed it. You have to be able to have a game that isn't just attention grabbing, but attention sustaining. It has to have enough ups and downs. It has to have enough zip to, you know, really make people want to dive into it, to really dig in. But at the same time, you need to have cards that are sleepers, things that will pay off the more time you put into the game. If everything is just, you know, even if it's balanced but big and splashy, you get a lot of bang up front, but that is not necessarily enough to sustain it over the course of a year or 3 years or, you know, right. 6 years.
Right. So you mentioned taking out some of the when we're talking about revised core, you and Lucas kind of tossed around the idea of taking out some of these problem cards, maybe replacing them with cards that have already been released. What were some of your other goals of this revised core project?
Well, I would say besides general card pool balance, I was looking to create a better out-of-the-box experience.
Mm.
The average person who buys a core set is buying something so that they have essentially a board game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to buy one core set and that's going to last them for months.
Mm-hmm.
And if they really dig the game, you know, maybe they'll buy a deluxe expansion or maybe a couple of the booster packs. Getting them to go beyond those first, say, three purchases is kind of difficult because that's just not the kind of player that they are.
Right.
They're looking for something that's fun that they can pick up, play a few times and put down, and, you know, maybe it'll hit their gaming table again in a month.
Right.
Which is different than, you know, probably a lot of your listeners, different from myself, which is, you know, you're playing multiple games, you know, a week.
Hmm.
You know, you travel and you go to stores for game night kits and regionals and, you know, your nationals or maybe even the world championships. Like, those are completely different groups and they outnumber us, you know, by orders of magnitude. Like,
right.
it's not even close. So looking at what is going to create the best experience for them, I think was probably my top design goal, other than to bring, you know, balance to the card pool as a whole.
Yeah. No, and I think that's really important too, because FFG has got this LCG model, which it's a make what you want out of it experience. So you can get one core set and that's standalone and that's good. Or you can have multiple copies of the core set and that gives you a lot of deck building options that should last you again for, you know, dozens of plays, right? And then you can buy more cards on top of that to expand your collection, and then you can get into it as a hobby and go to, you know, regular meetups or whatever. So,
mm-hmm.
Which exactly. I think is really fascinating. You're designing almost multiple games in one with that.
Oh, model. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is actually, which frequently I don't think is recognized by players of any tier, is that the better of a out-of-the-box self-contained experience we can make, the more likely people are to convert into buying more games, more products. Like, okay, well, I really love this and it's really great, and, you know, I heard that they have like these you know, mini runners. Like, that would be cool to add three new runners. I'm going to buy this box. And,
yes.
Oh, you know, yes. Actually, I heard about, you know, they have sort of like a campaign narrative thing going on. I totally, you know, love my pandemic legacy or whatever. And so I'm going to try out, you know, Terminal Directive. When you make a game that is gratifying to play at the lowest levels, it's easier to convert those people into more serious, more long-term players, mm-hmm. you know, people who will become competitive players. When you make something for a competitive player, they're looking for entirely different things on the whole.
Yes.
It's much harder to woo a casual gamer to even make that first purchase of something that is very much geared towards the competitive player, let alone mm-hmm. then convert them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start talking about a couple of the changes. I don't want to dwell on each individual thing because we could be here for hours discussing the thoughts that went into whether or not you wanted two indexing and one maker's eye or whatever. Let's start with the runner side. Shaper has changed a little bit. Probably the biggest thing is switching over from Kate to Chaos Theory.
And I
really like that change. I mean, not that Chaos Theory has this really amazing, cool ability, but at the same time, over the course of Netrunner, we've learned that the more easily applied economic value cards often beat out the more interesting niche cards. And I think Kate's an example of that, right?
Yeah, very much so. Mac was definitely one of my favorite runners, and it's really hard to design things that are not going to make the things that I do on a regular basis easier or somehow profit off of just playing the game. Mm-hmm. I think that Lucas and I had done a pretty good job of making some compelling shapers, but the keeping other cards balanced price-wise when she was going to be giving them a discount is always kind of hard mm-hmm. because, like, oh, okay, well, since I only have to pay this much for it, you know, I'm going to put in a bunch of them and I can play multiples. Like, okay, well, now we have to increase the price. Okay, well, now Kate is the only person playing right. it, and everybody else is like, I would, but it's too expensive.
Yeah, and in a game like Netrunner where a card is balanced by its cost, anything that affects universally the cost is going to universally affect then the balance for whatever that whole swath of the card design card pool is, right? So now yeah. every hardware and every program has to be measured up against the Kate discount, and, you know, not only does that limit design space, but now it's like this arbitrary cost that's added into every new card, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think that she probably would have been better off if she was just programs or just hardware, or if she was programs, like it was just icebreakers or non-icebreaker types. Like, if she were more limited,
yes,
I don't think there would have been a problem at all.
Yes. Because then it's a little bit more niche. If you're doing it based on like a subtype too, if you said all mods get discounts, right? Then,
yeah.
then you have a lot more control as opposed to just, well, every piece of hardware now this applies to.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was ultimately what ended up breaking pay-per-view Kate is yes. that we could no longer design, you know, economy cards for the runner because that deck type just made it, it just broke the cost curve.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, pay-per-view Kate, was too strong. The level of ubiquity during her plays was a problem for us. You know, when you're looking at 40%, give or take, of the runner side being done by a specific runner ID, that's a problem.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. So moving on to Criminal, we see a little bit more changes here. The big one is Account Siphon, right? Like, that is mm-hmm. the card that Divine Criminals. And now it's going to be gone. How do you feel about it? What do you
I am
think?
super happy and excited that it's gone. I think I actually, sorry, I've got like someone messaging me about about the Conor Mayweather fight the other day, and I think I just called out prepaid Kate as pay-per-view Kate. I'm sorry, I'm really not great
I
at
thought that was a
multitasking.
cool nickname, like instead of saying
It
PP,
was not.
VP Kate. I was like, oh, he calls it pay-per-view. That's sweet.
Yeah. No, but actually pay-per-view is a name that I have for a different runner. But I can't go into that.
Ooh, maybe it's a future runner.
I don't,
No
who
comment. No
knows?
comment.
It's, you know, no comment.
Yes, but account
But yeah,
siphon.
that was me. So yeah, Account Siphon conceptually is a great card.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you're going to take some money from the court. You're going to get some portion of that, but you're going to get, you know, some tags, and tags are generally speaking not great.
Right.
The problem is, if I can do that to you again and again and again and again and again, I can lock you out from playing the game.
Right.
And not like a cool lockout where there are kind of ways around it. Like as a runner getting locked out of servers, like, okay, well, there's all this ice. I got to try and find my breaker, or, you know, find my way jumping over a piece of ice or derezzing something or trashing something. But they're like temporaries. But if I, every time I get some amount of credits, you just snag it from me again, it prevents me from being able to really participate within the game.
Right. And it's not a very skill intensive card when, or it's not a very skill intensive strategy if all you're trying to do is maximize your recursion so that you can play more and more account siphons, right?
It's not difficult of a concept. The strategy is not hard. The part that does require, you know, play is, when do I start spamming it? When do I stop? When do I, you know, am I clearing the tags? Do I want to go tag me? If I keep them so broke that I have like eight tags, they're never going to be able to, you know, land any damage on me because they just won't be able to afford those damage cards. Like
Right.
that's where the skill comes in. But you know, ultimately, it's not particularly fun for most people to play
Right.
in an environment where they're completely choked out. And every time they finally start to get, you know, ahead, they're kicked back down the stairs.
Right. Right.
But that said, that is not necessarily in and of itself a reason to get rid of it. There are a lot of ways of beating that strategy. Getting rid of your opponent's heap is a great way to prevent recursion.
Right.
Icing up your headquarters with low cost ice early in the game is a pretty good way of being able to keep them out, at least until they start finding their breakers. And then it comes back down to, like, you know, quote unquote regular net runner, where you're, you know, at a race to keep them out while they're trying to get in. The problem is new players. Like there are two cards that are just not fun to have hit you multiple games in a row, and it makes you have a bad experience, and it kind of makes you not want to play much. And
Yeah.
Account Siphon is one of them. If you hit somebody who's a beginner with Account Siphon, they're going to get salty. And if you manage to get a second Account Siphon out, and remember, there's no real meaningful recursion in that first core set, but you get that second one out, and they are, being a new player, are probably done. Even if they have the cards in their deck that will allow them to get back, they've probably gone in tilt at that point. They're just having a bad feeling. And even if they win, they're not going to have had a good of a time as if they had what to them would have appeared more of an even back and forth.
Right. And although Account Siphon might feel like a balanced card in terms of, yeah, you gotta take these tags as part of the ability, there's not a whole lot of counterplay innately there, right? It's like you put down
Yeah.
the ice, hopefully you put down the right ice, and hopefully the Account Siphons won't, screw you over. But sometimes they do. So
Yeah.
no, I agree with that. And then the other big loss for Criminal is Desperado, and it's being replaced with Doppelganger, I gotta tell you, I love Doppelganger, so I am all about this.
So do I.
The main reason to not play Doppelganger was just because Desperado was debatably a little bit easier to get the benefit from. But I mean, I've been trying to play Doppelganger for years, so now everyone's in the same boat that I am.
You're welcome. For Desperado, it was another case of getting money to do the thing that you need to do anyway, generally speaking, to win. And it wasn't like Gabe, where, hey, it's a one-time thing off of this specific server. It's an every time thing, and that was just too much.
Now I'm curious if Michael Boggs is going to see this, see the Desperados leaving, think about all the Justin Bieber he heard over the summer, and make a new console called Despacito that just does it the first time, and it costs like five instead of three. It'll be great.
I did actually see somebody make a similar joke. They hadn't brought Michael into it, but they did say that the next cycle was going to have a new console called Despacito. But yeah, Desperado, just that gain a credit every time you make a successful run on any server for only three costs was way too good. Like, that card should be at least five, if not six. You know, it should take two turns of running for you to be able to be out on top. Three should have been HQ first time, or maybe even just, you know, any central server, or even just, you know, a remote server. You know, in the core set, it wasn't problematic. It wasn't until halfway through the second cycle or beginning of the third cycle where it became clear that it was just, you know, pumping out too many credits for what it was, and people were finding ways of making criminal just
A little bit economically oppressive is how I think of it, right? Like,
that's actually a really great phrase.
where you just can't get ahead of them because you don't have enough taxing ice in your deck where you really want to ice up archives, or you've got a naked pad campaign, and therefore they've got a security testing with a Desperado, a John Masanori, and maybe a data sucker, and they're just getting so much value that you can't ever catch up from that, and you can't really get rid of some of those cards unless you tag them, you know, so that's tricky.
So Desperado had to go, and Doppelganger to me was the natural replacement for it. I mean, ultimately, I think it's a better console, and I don't say that to mean a more powerful console. I mean, the effect that it does is really good, but it's also really balanced, you know, especially in comparison.
No, and I think Doppelganger works a lot better with a lot of other cards too, where, okay, I'll throw down a bank job, make a run, get my bank job money, then I get to make another run, and I am going to trash that pad campaign. So now I've made three, and you've lost your pad campaign, and that's only one click. Like that's a cool ability without making the game feel broken like a Desperado kind of does. So.
And Doppelganger has a built-in restriction to it, although a lot of people don't really stop to think about it too much. And that's that second run that you're going to make in that turn is immediately after a successful run. So there's no drawing back up, there's no clicking for more credits. It's just, okay, I made it in. Now I have to be able to do that again without any kind of prep. So I had to do all of my prep for that before that first run in order to be able to make it through both of them.
Okay, so let's move on to the big one, Anarch. Holy smokes. We're just gutting the whole, like, the virus focus that the corset Anarch had, and we're replacing it with just trashing a bunch of stuff Anarch. I like it. I like, you know, getting away from the noise thing. He's interesting, but, you know, without the ability to recur a lot of cards from archives, it can make noise kind of more reliant on randomness. Did they bin your agendas, or did they just bin other cards that you don't care about? So.
And we didn't really get rid of the focus on viruses. I mean, there are definitely some viruses that made it into the core set, but we did get rid of noise, and that changed the focus of the viruses. It was less about just spamming them out to force needed cards into archives, and it's now more about tactical use of, you know, any given virus program.
You know, some of the other Anarch, like, force trash effects, stuff like Alice Merchant or Hemorrhage, Hacktivist Meeting, Maw, these things are usually taking a card out of the Corp's hand, which means that the Corp has a little bit more play because they can kind of control maybe what's in their hand. Oh, I really don't want to lose this, so I'm going to go ahead and play it or install it now. Whereas Noise is just taking random cards off the top of your deck. Hope you didn't need those. And it's just too easy to do. And it's not interactive, necessarily.
Yeah. It's the same general problem with data leak reversal. Just that ability to peel cards right off of the top with, you know, quite honestly, little need of interaction. Like, that is the biggest problem. Mm-hmm. And you can compare that to, you know, potential Unleashed, you know, Jinteki's version of, you know, a deck discard ID. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to essentially transfer damage to your deck as well, but you are going to be the one that is going to have to, you know, suffer the net damage. And most net damage happens on the runner's turn, not the corpse turn. So it's the choices that the runner is making that's putting themselves in that situation. And so the corp is having to plan, you know, ahead and make commitments in order to make it work. And sometimes it's just as simple as, like, okay, well, I'm going to take big net damage ice and stick it out on the central servers and just let them run into it. But, you know, that only works until they find their, you know, their icebreakers for those. So
yeah,
it's really up to, it's really dependent on the runner, the runner's actions. And that makes it much more palatable rather than just watching your deck go away and you're not actually having any interaction with that.
Well, you got to bring up Medium and Parasite. You know, Medium I always felt like was the best R&D access card, and it's in the Archives faction, so to speak, right? Where Shaper is supposed to be R&D, so I'm happy to see Medium gone.
I think that, I mean, Medium was a great card, and I'm hopeful that, you know, Michael will bring some version of it back in the future. But yeah, it was, I think, was just a little too good in a faction that really shouldn't be about R&D access. Anarch really isn't even about archives access. It's really about just central pressure. Hmm. But Medium was just so impactful for R&D.
Mm-hmm. And I like that the R&D pressure in the core set has been more redirected towards event-based accesses, where you still have Maker's Eye, but you also added in indexing. So, you know, those are kind of those burst effects. And then we also have something like Equivocation, and maybe that pairs well with something like a Maya or a Mirror, one of these consoles that rewards you for hitting R&D multiple times. Even like a Maya or Mirror plus Equivocation plus a Top Hat, like, that doesn't even really, that almost holds a candle to what Medium can do, right?
Yeah. So It doesn't get you that hard R&D lock where the runner is always seeing more cards than you at every possible turn. Yeah. It becomes a case where you are able to get some level of play, and it takes a lot more setup on their part to take advantage of all of that.
Yeah.
Just a lot more work.
I imagine that you took out Parasite because ultimately it proved to be maybe too easy to destroy ice and lower the strength of ice. Thoughts on getting out of there?
Parasite for a really long time, I think, was really fine. I think that ultimately the issue started to become people stopped playing ice. People stopped playing lots of different varieties of it just because things are getting destroyed so easily. And Parasite was ultimately the card doing most of the destruction. Right. Like, the other cards may have been doing the thing that got it down to zero, but Parasite was the one that was actually making it go away.
Yeah.
And so Parasite had to go away.
I can see another form of Parasite coming back too. You know, I don't have a problem with ice destruction. It's too easy of ice destruction that gets, you know, kind of problematic, I think. So.
That is definitely the issue, and I'm sure at some point something like that will pop up.
Yeah. I also have to applaud you for taking out Yogg, because from the first time that I sat down to play Netrunner, I was like, Yogg seems kind of broken. Like, invalidating ice, which is kind of what the game centers around, is ice. You know, it doesn't seem like something that necessarily feels good. And again, this is in a faction where they're not supposed to necessarily be great at breaking code gates.
No, they're not.
Yeah.
And the concept behind it was a very solid one. You know, it's like, okay, this icebreaker can't have its strength altered. So the cheap, gear check ice, it's going to walk through, but literally everything else stops it. And the idea of, data sucker, the corpse will purge and it'll be fine. And so conceptually it was, it made sense, but ultimately there were too many ways of getting code gates to have less strength or to give Yogg an increased strength. And at the same time, it forced every code gate to be any good at all to have to be a strength 5 code gate. Like that just 0 through 3 was literally worthless. 4 was, well, it'll work for a little while until they find their, insert name of booster here. Or, data sucker, which of course just lowers it. So.
No, I have no complaints about saying goodbye to Yogg, so thumbs up there. Let's switch over to the corpse side. Look at Haas Bayreuth, and obviously the big change here is the change in ID. And I don't want to dwell on whether or not Stronger Together is bad, because I don't think it is, and some people do, and for whatever reason they're very passionate about that, so whatever. But I will say that Engineering the Future is very easy to play, and it doesn't need a specific strategy, and that it gives you liquid cash. It's not even lowering the cost of a certain thing by one, it's just giving you the cash, and so that makes it really easy, which makes it really popular. In my mind, it's kind of like the Taylor Swift of Netrunner, where it's not necessarily the best music, it's not the best card that's out there, but it's really popular. And you know what? Sometimes Damon Stone's got to come in and say, "All right, if this is the only ID that you guys are going to play, I got to take it out. Look what you made me do." Guys, come on.
ETF is definitely probably the most loved and respected HB identity. The sad part is that the general perception of its power is, again, like orders of magnitude higher than most of the others. Again, much like Kate, ETF was just giving you money to do the thing that you need to do to play the game. And again, if it had been like, hey, every time you play something in the root, or every time you put something in a server, or every time you install a piece of ice, like any one of those would have been, I think, perfectly balanced. And the kind of restriction where it's like, okay, well, I'm going to use this when I'm playing Glacier HB, because it's always going to give me, when I'm playing out one piece of ice the first time, the first ice, I'm getting money. The second piece of ice, is break even. And the third piece of ice, I'm only having to pay one for. Like, absolutely, I'm going to make all my central servers iced up, a fair amount. And my scoring server is probably going to have 3, 4 pieces of ice on it. But that's not what it was for. That's not how it was used. And I think it was really stunting the player's ability to do new and different things.
Let's talk about the 3-2 agendas that all the factions are getting now. Everyone's getting their Genesis Cycle 3-2 agenda. Project Beale, Braintrust, Project Atlas, Project Vitruvius. So truthfully, you know, I'm trying to gear up mentally for rotation, and I'm getting used to the idea that sometimes I'm actually going to have to install and advance stuff, because I'm thinking, man, I can either include 20 three ones in a deck, or I'm actually going to have to do like 4 2s and 5 3s. So I was a little bit looking forward to that because I thought that might make advanceable traps more of a thing. Why did you guys ultimately decide to go with the 3 2s?
We did not want the concept of fast advance to die out. We think that it is too much of a fundamental archetype for the game to let it just wither on the vine. So keeping 3-2s around, I thought, was going to be helpful for the game. But only having essentially one, therefore only 6 points worth of it, was a still going to force you to have to figure out which 4-2s or 3-1s or 5-2s or even 5-3s that you were going to, you know, include in your deck.
Yeah. I want to talk about Jinteki here in this revised core, because in the classic core, I kind of felt like Jinteki ultimately was the weakest. It was the hardest to use. They didn't have very much money at all. You know, they've got a couple copies of Cell Portal, which is super expensive. You know, I felt like playing Jinteki as a new player in that core set, it was really difficult. Yeah. And so what you have done is taken out some of the more cumbersome, difficult, or niche cards and replaced them with basically everyone's favorite Genesis Cycle Jinteki cards and then Celebrity Gift. So it's basically Jinteki Christmas, as far as I'm concerned. This is great.
Well, anybody who knows me knows that Jinteki was my first love, and I still go back to it on the regular. And I would say that it wasn't the weakest. I'd say NBN was the weakest. I would say that Jinteki was the hardest. Like, once you understood fast advance and you started, you know, putting your biotic labors into NBN, it wasn't that hard to figure out what to do with it. But Jinteki just didn't have enough in the runs. Jinteki was really just about the, is it a Project June bug or is it a agenda? You're not going to know unless you come and check. And right. if you were good at playing poker, if you understood how bluffing works, if you were willing to throw away an agenda or two or run the risk of throwing them away so you could get a read on your opponent, how they played, like Jinteki was your jam. You could do wonders with that.
Right.
But if you were not into bluffing, if you were not into reading people, and you didn't understand that that was the way to win with Jinteki, like it was very nearly impossible to win in any other way with it, you were hosed. You're just not going to do well at it, and you were not going to be good at it. So I did think that it was necessary to give them enough tools that even if you were bad at bluffing, you could still take advantage of your opponent by having enough possible choices that they could just never be sure.
Yeah. And my favorite thing on this list of stuff that you've added to the Jinteki faction is Trick of Light, because that really enables you to recover from maybe any time investment that you've put into advancing a trap, or maybe it is an agenda, or maybe it's not, but it's been sitting on the table for so long, and he just keeps putting two advancement tokens on it, and then he fast fans out of Brain Trust. So I think Trick of Light is a very important card for Jinteki to have, and I'm really happy to see it stay.
Yeah, it's really a twofer. Trick of Light and Ronin, I think, are the most important cards that have been placed into Jinteki, because the Ronin added with the Project Junebug is, okay, something's being advanced. Now there's three possible options, right? And even if there's only one Ronin in the set, I know that if I let it get to four, I could be in serious trouble. So I kind of need to go check it. And if someone manages to guess right, like, nope, it's not important, I'll just keep cards in my hand at the end of my turn. If it's a Ronin, I will survive as long as they don't have a duo of neural EMP in their hand. And then you're right, they play a couple trick of lights and are, once they realize it's not going to do the kill to a brain trust, or, it was a Project June bug, that trick of light pulls it off. It just, that combo, those two cards just give them so many more options in play.
Definitely. So looking at NBN as a faction, I'm kind of not surprised to see Astroscript hit the road, because we've all known that that's been really above the power curve, and but something I was happy to see was Breaking News, and not necessarily because Breaking News in and of itself is problematic, but it combos really strongly with a lot of other cool effects out there, and it's kind of like you got to do one or the other, because if you have them both together, then 24/7 becomes really, really strong. Boom becomes really, really strong. Happy to see that one go, I think.
Yeah, it needed to go. Once it became possible to forfeit it, and Lucas had ruled that the tags stay, it was on my list of, this card is a problem. It breaks something that I believe is a fundamental aspect of what makes it balanced. Yeah, it was on my list of things to go.
Yeah, yeah. You talked about wanting to keep Fast Advance as a thing, but we're also getting rid of Sansan's City Grid. I'm wondering if that's because maybe the effect is cool, but the numbers on Sansan are kind of off. Something like an Oberth Protocol maybe would be better for that, where the numbers are just... a lot, like it's two to trash and you have to forfeit an agenda to res it.
I think Sansan was a little too easy. NBN Fast Advance, I think overall was too easy, and it was not something that I thought should be their mainstay in a core set. Like, it didn't make sense with their core ID. I thought that traces and tags were really the thing that would make more sense for them, and there would be future opportunities to make Fast Advance stuff that was a little bit more specific in NBN flavor.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. And okay, we got to finish off with a big W here. Scorched Earth is no longer in Wayland, and that's obviously been a huge part of their identity as a faction. But you have not gotten rid of Meat Damage, because they also have Dedicated Response Team and they have Punitive Counter-Strike. So tell me your thoughts on these decisions here.
I'll be quite honest. That was the most problematic one for me. I went back and forth about what to do with Corset Wayland. And my former boss, who's was at the time VP of product development, Wayland was his favorite faction, and Meat Damage was the way that he preferred to kill people. He was actually one of the very first people I went to. I'm like, okay, so I've been hemming and hawing on this, and I have an idea. I want you to just hear me out on this. It's like, what if there's no Scorched Earth in the core set? And he just gave me this blank look. And like, but it's not that the Meat Damage is gone entirely. Here is the thinking behind it. And this is something that Lucas and I had talked about a few times together. Scorched Earth is very much sort of a binary card. It's like, okay, are you tagged? Do you have any amount of tags? Yes, great, Scorch. No, okay, I'm gonna hold it until I get the way I have of tagging you.
Yeah.
And it just hit you exactly the same, no matter how many tags you had. And so the first tag was really the only tag that mattered.
Right.
Everything else was just, icing on the cake. And the only people who cared about having multiple tags was NBN if they were gonna do like cycle graphics.
Right.
And it also set a hard limit for Meat Damage to cost to tag ratio.
Hmm.
Right. So it's this many credits for this much damage for this many tags. Anything that was not that was just, well, why would I ever play this when I could just have scorched earth? Or like, okay, I'll put one in so I have four ways of delivering meat damage, but I'm really only hoping to get my one of my scorched earths. So the idea of pulling it out allows it to be brought back in at some later point, that it, with a little bit more granularity,
Sure,
a little bit
sure.
more fine-tuned control. There are enough cards now that do meat damage in differing amounts and in differing ways and requiring more than a single tag that I think that ultimately it was the right choice, and it makes for a more satisfying experience playing Wayland in the core,
Yeah.
where
No,
you
I
don't feel
totally
like
agree.
you don't feel like you have to get that scorched earth to win the game. It's like, oh, I'm the money faction, and when you do something that pisses me off, I'm going to punch you a lot.
Right. No, I mean the binary nature of tags, that argument that I've read about and heard about for years kind of leads its way back to scorched earth being the problem. Also, I need to give you special bonus points for including false lead in the core set because it's a deceivingly useful agenda that's very easy to score. It works with Bioroids. It works with tagging strategies. It works with Jinteki by not letting you draw up after you get hit with some net damage. So it is actually quite universal, and I really like that you've decided to include that.
Well, thank you. I was it was a card that I thought was super useful for new players to have access to. Part of what you want to do when you're building a core set is make things internally consistent, but also provide learning opportunities. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I was using this card this way, and now I see that there's another way to use it. It makes the card even more, you know, versatile, and you feel good about it, and your play level just goes up.
Definitely. So one of the things that has me really excited is the idea of new art on some of these old classic cards. I really like it both as like the excited consumer and then also from like the business sales standpoint. I think it's really smart. Do you have any comments on which cards we're seeing new art on? We've seen like Gabe and Chaos Theory, of course, you know, Crypsis, Ghost Branch, Heimdall, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the most that I can say in regards to what cards have new art is if you take a look at if you stop and you think about what cards should look like in Netrunner today, and then you go through the original core set and you pull out all the cards that don't match that, most of those are probably the ones.
Cool. Pretty good hint. And listener, I'm sure that you have already dug out your core set and are looking through all the art right now to try to guess what we're going to get new art on. So, Damon, obviously, you've got to be pretty happy with the end result of this revised core set. So, why do you think this is going to be a better out-of-the-box experience for new players?
I think that the runners are more balanced for each other. I think the corps are more balanced towards each other, and I think ultimately they are more balanced across the line to each other. And that I think is super important. The decks have a greater variety of cards for the most part. That means that some of the cards drop down in frequency a little bit, while other ones went up. Like I tried to make sure that everybody had a really good economy package, and make sure that all the runners had a good amount of breakers to be able to use. That the corpse had a good amount of ice to be able to use, and really try to make each faction coherent. That if you flip through the cards, you'll understand how this deck is supposed to be played.
Yes, and I think that's really important to be able to piece those together because not only does it help you as a new player have a better experience, but it's more exciting when you start comboing cards together and you're thinking like, "Oh yeah, this deck's cool because all of my beefy ice is even beefier because of my ID." or all of my tracer ice that I have imported from other factions, now all that gets better because of my ID. Why do you think the revised core will be better for the competitive health of the game?
Well, I think that for most of the reasons why I had talked about removing certain cards, I think that players themselves have relied too heavily on some of the power cards. I think that some of the power cards have encouraged unhealthy growth in certain directions for the game and for the metagame. And I think removing them is going to open up a lot more choices and just cause a lot of people to rethink some of their basic assumptions about how certain factions are supposed to work and what sort of things that they're going to have to face. I think it's just going to make people set aside some of their preconceived notions, and that will create a better balanced environment to play in. Yeah, you can never guess how people are going to go. The most that we can ever do is come up with some ideas, test them thoroughly, and then cross our fingers that the way that our play testers took to them and acted about them and reacted to them is similar to how, the thousands upon thousands of players, around the world are going to do it in a similar fashion.
So the newly announced Katara cycle, I believe, was the last cycle of cards that you designed. Is that right?
That is correct.
Was that cycle designed specifically with the revised core set in mind?
Yes, it was.
Very, very exciting. That's very cool. Also, a little sidebar for me. I really like the Seven Wonders Ice, the Colossus, Horda, Mausolus. Comments on if we might see more of those in the future? That's a cool
That
theme.
sort of thing is totally up to Michael.
Cool.
I am hopeful that he'll get all seven out there, but Michael's the dog now, man. So he will figure it out.
A couple questions on alternative formats. Any thoughts on Cash Refresh? Was that just a format to encourage attendance at like a 2-day regional, or do you think Cash Refresh might get some organized play support for maybe like CR-only events or things like that?
Understanding that I'm speaking to you now as a fan and not as a current employee of, Fantasy Flight Games, I certainly hope so. I thought Cash Refresh was, barring the bidding for who's first player, which I understand why that was the choice, but barring that, I think that it is a really interesting format.
I agree.
And totally the way that I would go for a more limited, easier on new players to get into the competitive world without having to feel that they need to own everything.
Yes. I love it as a format. I've played in a couple of online Cash Refresh tournaments. They're a blast. It's a fun deck building exercise, and the meta is constantly changing, so really fun.
If they were only going to choose one more format, I would have to say I would hope that they would choose Cash Refresh over any form of legacy format where they keep everything legal. Like I think that more restrictions to create more creativity and to allow newer players alternate methods of playing is ultimately the wiser choice from a long-term health of the game and the community than putting forward something else where people now need to try and find out of print cards.
Yeah, no, and I can see why in other card games it makes sense to do more of like that legacy or eternal style game. I would be very skeptical about it for an LCG like Netrunner. So, but we'll see what happens. We'll see.
As would I mean, like, hopefully if there are people, if there are players who are super jazzed about it, they will get on it themselves. There's tons of really excellent people making some really cool events around the world, and if there is a large enough interest in it, I'm pretty confident that they will step up and take it on.
Yeah. My last question for you, Damon, and it's a big one. After you've
Okay.
been lead designer, And after you've been, talking about Netrunner basically every day, are you sick of it? Are you sick of
Oh,
Netrunner yet?
no, not at all. I love Netrunner.
That's awesome.
I have not yet dipped my toes into the competitive side as, a quote unquote civilian yet. I've been really wanting for all of my stuff to come out for a couple different reasons. One is it's always weird to play with cards that you've seen multiple versions of and then trying to remember, oh wait, that's a 5/3, not a 5/2, or oh, that's three to trash, or it doesn't have that kicker, or that thing that I'm afraid that, my opponent is going to play, that if she played it would totally wreck me, is not something that's even released yet. Like it's really weird to play, in a contemporary time, but with future cards in your head, or worse, alternate history versions of cards in your head.
I can't even imagine. That would be very weird. That would be very weird.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I have people ask as I reach across the table and say, "Can I see that card?" It's like, I thought this was one of your designs. I'm like, "Yeah, it is. Shut up. Let me see the
I saw
card."
five different versions of this. Cut me some slack.
Yeah.
Are you going to Worlds this year?
I don't think I'm going to be able to go to Worlds this year. I kind of promised my wife that I was going to not do any cons or any tournaments this year. Just so that we could get everything here established in our life in California. And, it was a pretty easy promise to make when I was still wrapping up this stuff. And, now that I haven't actively been, partaking in it, I'm like jonesing to get back out there and, to hang out with friends and play some games and, get myself completely smashed by people who just know the cards just way better than I do. Hell, even know my own rulings way better than I do. I'm really looking forward to it. But the thing that I said was, I was going to give it a year off and then I'd come back into it, refreshed. I still don't know how serious of a competitor I'm likely to be, but I do look forward to being able to, connect with the San Francisco East Bay metas out here and make my way to some regionals and maybe even worlds.
Well, Damon, I have to thank you for spending some time with me today talking about all this stuff. It's very exciting as a fan, and I know that this is going to be a great entry point for new players into the game, and I hope you go to bed at night knowing that you've created something that brings a lot of joy to a lot of people. So, thank you for
Oh,
that.
thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Graham.
Well, it's the least I can do. I know I'm kind of a big
Yeah.
deal. No.
Yeah,
All right, well, let me wrap this thing up. You, avid listener, you can find us at least twice a month at shipmentfromshiloh.podomatic.com. You can shoot me a tweet at GrahamCrackerGo. My username on all things Netrunner is PureFlight. Thanks to Foundation for the amazing theme music. Thanks to you for listening in. Thanks again to the amazing, the great Damon Stone.
thank you, Graham.
That's our show. This is Graham Carlson signing off for the night. Stay safe, New Angeles, and join us next time on Shipment from Shiloh.